This podcast is supported by the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, one of America's leading medical research schools. How will advances in artificial intelligence transform medical research and medical care? To find out, we invite you to read a special supplement to Science Magazine prepared by Icon Mount Sinai in partnership with Science. Just visit our website at science.org and search for Frontiers of Medical Research-Artificial Intelligence. On May 1st and May 2nd, Icon Mount Sinai and the New York Academy of Sciences will be convening a major symposium in New York City on the new wave of AI in healthcare. For more information and to register, please visit events.nyas.org/AI Health. That's events.nyas.org/AI Health. The Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. We find a way. This week's episode is brought to you in part by the NOMIS and Science Young Explorer Award. Are you doing excellent research that deserves recognition? The NOMIS and Science Young Explorer Award recognizes bold young researchers who ask fundamental questions at the intersection of the life and social sciences. Researchers who take risks to address relevant and exciting questions with creative approaches, regardless of the research outcome. Submissions are due May 15th. Visit science.org/NOMIS, that's N-O-M-I-S, to apply today. Welcome to the Science Podcast for May 16th, 2014. I'm Sarah Crespi. In this week's show, we learn how to evade back action effects when measuring a quantum system, and David Grimm is here to give us a roundup of stories from our daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Classical physics cannot explain many of the things seen at the atomic level or below. Instead, the questions posed by observations at this scale led to the foundation of quantum mechanics and a much better understanding of the behavior of the extremely tiny. Now, research is pushing in the other direction with attempts to observe quantum behavior in groups of atoms and small structures. I spoke with Keith Schwab about avoiding back action effects when analyzing the behavior of a tiny drum.
So one of the most basic measurements you can make is asking where something is. And typically we shine light and look what reflects off to determine where something is. And when you think deeply about the quantum limits of that process, eventually the impact of the individual photons will limit the sensitivity to motion. And so we show this in this experiment that even microwave photons, which are really tiny, can actually cause forces. And more importantly, we show how to avoid this.
So what exactly is back action? Is that what you just described?
Yeah, so that's one component of back action. So whenever you make a measurement of some object or some system under study, you can affect that system. And any of those effects on that system are called back action. So some back action effects are good, and some of them are bad. Like, for instance, if you shine light at something and it pushes the object, that's called radiation pressure. That's kind of benign. No one cares too much about that. But if the pressure is not steady due to the quantum fluctuations, that will cause a force noise, and that's not good. That's going to limit our sensitivity. That's going to push the object around eventually.
Well, so let's talk about the setup that you used here in this work when you're trying to engineer a way around back action effects.
Yeah, so our system that we studied was a tiny aluminum drum that's about 40 microns in diameter, which is, you know, about the diameter of a hair. And it vibrates at radio frequencies at around 4 megahertz. And that little mechanical device is coupled to an electrical resonator. It's a superconducting circuit. And these kinds of electrical resonators are used in qubit circuits. They're used widely in astrophysics. But we use them here to couple to the motion of a small mechanical device. With that kind of setup, we can send microwaves into this circuit. And how the microwaves interact with the mechanical device will tell us about the motion of the mechanical structure. But eventually, if you turn up the microwave source to high enough power, the actual quantum nature of the microwave field will start to push random forces onto the little mechanical structure that we're trying to measure. So it starts to perturb it, and that's the radiation pressure shot noise. That's the back action effect that is not good. That's essentially enforcing the uncertainty principle on your measurement.
So what are you trying to measure with this tiny mechanical oscillator? What kind of phenomenon would you study using this device?
The area that we're in and the questions of the community of people that we work in largely are captured by the question, this one question, which is the small world appears quantum, the large world appears classical, and the question is there a boundary between those worlds? And so we would like to know, can you do quantum physics with larger and larger objects? And so this little mechanical drum is a relatively large object. You know, you can see it under an optical microscope pretty easily. And we'd like to know, can that be a fully quantum thing? If it can, that's fascinating. That's the wave-like properties of a big object made of many atoms. And if it can't, why not? Can it because of fundamental physics, or is it just a matter of doing the experiment, putting it in the right environment? That's the bigger questions that we're after.
What kind of signal would you expect or would you see if this little mechanical drum was acting in a quantum manner?
Yeah, it's tricky. You're looking for various kinds of output signals, and these are, typically in our experiments, they're encoded into the microwaves that come out of the device. But you're looking for signals where those signals definitely come from the uncertainty principle of the mechanical structure, for instance, or signals which show you that the mechanical structure was interfering with something, interfering with itself or with, let's say, a piece of electronics like a qubit. And so you're looking for these kind of subtle signals in the light, the microwave frequency light that comes out of the device.
You're running into these limits. The measuring that you're doing is hitting a limit. How did you engineer around that? How did you try to solve this problem?
Well, you know, we actually turned back to the literature of 30 years ago. And what's fascinating about this story, at least to me, is that these questions were confronted back in the 1970s when people were thinking about the theoretical limits of the sensitivity of gravity wave detectors. And now that we talk about LIGO and other kinds of detectors around the world, they understood back in the 70s that the light would ultimately limit, and the radiation pressure noise from the quantum properties of the light would ultimately limit your sensitivity to the position, let's say, of a mirror when you're doing a gravity wave detector. And so when they realized that, they also came up with schemes of how you would avoid this radiation pressure noise. How do you sidestep it? So this technique that we implemented, we finally were successfully able to implement, had been proposed back in the mid-70s. But never been achieved.
And so can you explain kind of in the abstract what the technique was?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you just measure the motion of something, like you shine light on it and you're getting a signal which tells you where that object is continuously in time, then you're always limited by this force noise from the light. You can't get around it. It turns out that if you, instead of measure the full motion of the mechanical structure, if you can just measure part of the motion, and those are what are called the two quadratures of motion. Think of like sine omega t and cosine omega t as parts of the motion. So if you can measure only one quadrature, all the uncertainty principle force noise from the light goes into the other quadrature that you're not looking at. So you give up complete knowledge of the motion, but what you get is being insensitive to the force noise of the light.
So is it almost like a sample?
Yeah, it's kind of like sampling. It's like sampling at the right moments in time. That's a really excellent insight that you just had there. That's perfect. You're sampling it at the right time, at the right moments in phase, and it turns out when you do that correctly, the forces go to the other quadrature.
And so what does this evasion method get you? How much improvement did you see in the ability to measure finer and finer detail?
Yeah, so we were able to avoid the uncertainty principle noise of the light by 9 dB, which is nearly an order of magnitude. What this gets us, and as we get better at it and as our devices get better at realizing this, what we get is a really sharp tool where we can study the motion of a mechanical structure down at its quantum limit, where we're looking at motions near the uncertainty principle of the mechanical structure, but not perturbing the mechanics, not perturbing the actual signal that we're looking at.
What kind of research opportunities are opened up by being able to bring these measurements even closer to the limit?
Well, you know, for your readers who might not think a lot about mechanical structures, it turns out that the community is now producing devices that are at quantum mechanical limits, meaning like mechanical structures that are micron scale are now in the ground state. Groups at Santa Barbara have shown that you can produce entanglement with a qubit. I mean, mechanical devices are now quantum. That's the news flash of the last few years. But the point is that we're now at the point where mechanical structures are behaving in very simple quantum ways. We need measurement tools where we can probe the motion.
Keith Schwab, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks so much.
Keith Schwab and colleagues write about back action evasion in this week's issue. Now we have David Grimm, the editor for our online daily news site and author of a new book, Citizen Canine, Our Evolving Relationship with Cats and Dogs. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up, we have a story on preventing the next Godzilla. Not everyone is familiar with the details of Godzilla's origin story. Yes, he is a giant rampaging lizard monster that arose from the depths of the sea. But did you know he was called forth by radiation? Some even say the entire storyline of these many, many, many giant lizard movies came out of this threat of nuclear weapons and radiation. So, Dave, what are some of the dangerous effects that radiation have on the body?
Well, Godzilla aside, radiation can be very deadly. First, it strikes the bone marrow, so it can wipe out a lot of critical blood cells. But with high doses of radiation, something called radiation-induced gastrointestinal syndrome, or RIGS, happens. And that's basically when the intestines essentially get fried. And this can cause fluid loss, diarrhea, vomiting, and a lot of infections, which ultimately can lead to death.
So here we're looking at a study that's trying to prevent that from happening when you're exposed to radiation. How do they actually try to do this?
Well, researchers focused on a couple of proteins known as hypoxia-inducible factor 1 and 2. And what they know is that these proteins play a role in maintaining the integrity of the intestines. So they figured because radiation wreaks such havoc on the intestines, maybe they could boost the level of these proteins and protect the intestines and therefore protect us against radiation.
And so they first took a genetic approach where they actually made more of this protein in mice, and then they moved over to a drug-based approach. How much protection were they able to see with these interventions?
Well, what happened was this drug actually seemed to boost the levels of these two proteins. And what they found is that when they gave it to mice and the irradiated mice, the mice that did not receive the drug died within 10 days of exposure. But those that had been given the drug were still alive after 60 days. And what's more, even if they gave the drug after the mice had been exposed to radiation, they still had a much higher survival rate than the mice that hadn't been given the drug.
But this isn't going to prevent cancer arising later in life for these mice.
Well, it's hard to know whether these drugs are going to protect against the long-term impacts of radiation. But what the scientists think is happening is it's at least protecting the intestines long enough so they have time to repair themselves so you don't have some of these other long-term effects.
Is this being tested in people?
Well, what's really cool is this drug's actually already being tested in a clinical trial for anemia. So it's possible that if it is proven very effective against radiation, it could move to the market a lot quicker. So, for example, if there was another Fukushima, this could be a drug that's dispensed far and wide to protect the general population.
There's also mention of using this drug to decrease the effects of radiation treatment on cancer patients. Is that likely to be effective?
It's unclear. There's a lot of side effects of radiation therapy, and this could theoretically protect against those side effects. The problem is some research suggests that this may actually protect tumors from radiation, which is obviously the last thing that you want. So it's still a little unclear about how this could be applied to humans.
Next up, we have a story on the health of bullies. Bullying no longer belongs to the secretive domain of the playground and after-school hangout spots. Adults are on the lookout, seeking to save kids from punches, pinches, and psychological damage. But now there's another factor to worry about. CRP levels. So Dave, what's this initialism for?
This stands for C-reactive protein, and it's a marker of inflammation and disease. People with higher CRPs tend to have more chronic illness, including cardiovascular disease and diabetes and chronic pain. We already knew that bullying could have some long-term impacts. Kids that are bullied tend to be more suicidal when they're older. They also tend to have poorer health. But it was unclear why exactly this happened, and CRP may be the key to the puzzle.
So the researchers tried to look and see if bullied kids had different levels of this protein than other ones?
They did. They did this long-term study where they took kids that were about 16, surveyed them about whether they were bullied or whether they were bullies, took some blood, and then looked at their CRP levels over several years until they were about 21 years of age. And they found some pretty striking things. They found that the kids that were bullied had much higher CRP levels than the general population. What was really interesting was that bullies actually had lower levels of CRP than average.
And no one's trying to suggest that CRP causes bullying or lack of it.
That's right. This is just sort of a marker for why the people that are bullied may be having some of these chronic problems later in life. Because even years after the bullying incidents, a lot of these people that had elevated CRP levels continued to have elevated CRP levels, which could explain why the negative impacts of bullying last later on into life.
So does this mean that we should encourage kids to be bullies and preserve their health?
Probably not. It does suggest that, you know, we know actually already that people that tend to be well off, that tend to be higher on the social totem pole, also tend to be healthier. This could explain also why bullies are healthier, because they have an advantage or they take advantage of others, but probably not the best take-home point here. It does suggest that we should be much more vigilant about bullying, because now we have even stronger evidence of its long-term impacts on health.
Lastly, we have a story on the genetics of rascally rabbits. There have been many studies on the genetics of animal domestication. How did dogs go from slavering wolves to friendly companions? Is there a gene that's been switched off? But it turns out that this has been difficult to study. Dave, can you outline some of the reasons that this has been such a problematic area to research?
One of the biggest problems is that the ancestors of a lot of these domestic animals, whether it be dogs or horses or sheep, these animals were domesticated so long ago, you know, up to 10,000 or more years ago. So much time has passed that we have a really hard time comparing the modern animal to its ancestor.
What the researchers decided to do in this case is turn to rabbits. Why did they pick those animals?
Because rabbits are actually a fairly recently domesticated species. Scientists think they were domesticated around 1,400 years ago, and the event that may have led to their domestication was a pope declaring that rabbits technically qualified as fish and could be eaten during Lent, and that caused a lot of the priesthood to bring wild rabbits into the fold and start essentially domesticating them.
So where do the rabbits originate, and what do they look at in the wild and domesticated ones now?
Well, the rabbits actually have a pretty limited range. They're from Spain, Portugal, and southern France, so it's really easy to go back to those places and find the wild ancestors of today's rabbits. When the researchers compared the DNA, though, of these wild rabbits to their domestic cousins, instead of finding this one gene for domestication, which is what a lot of researchers had suspected, they found thousands of very small nuanced changes within the genome that seem to have led to domestication.
Do these results stand alone? Are there other animals that have been shown to have a similar domestication history written into their genes?
Well, it may be possible that something similar happened with rats. We don't think of rats as being domesticated, but actually the rats that live around us and the rats that we have as pets are actually far more domestic than their wild relatives. So something similar has been seen with rats, which suggests that whether we're talking about dogs, cats, or other animals, that this may hold true across most, if not all, domesticated species.
Okay, so what else is on the site this week?
Well, Sarah, we've got a story about creating the most magnetic thing in the universe. Also a story about how octopuses don't tie themselves in knots. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about why lectures are ineffective. Believe it or not, there's a policy angle there. Also about why UK research groups are pledging more openness in animal research. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for our online daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org. And that concludes this edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org or tweet to us at Science Magazine. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.